Okay. Rex, Helen, gentlemen, thanks for inviting me. I recently wrote a short article about HMS Melbourne that was published, and as a consequence of that, I was asked to give this talk. So what I'll do will be a bit of history. Some of you will know it, some may not. A bit about the ship and a few anecdotes, and hopefully that should take us through to closing time. And I've also got a few comments about HMS Ark Royal. Now, HMS Melbourne was originally laid down during the Second War at Vickers Armstrong in Barrow-in-Furness. She was launched in 1944 and named Majestic, and it was designed for service in the Arctic convoys as a light fleet carrier. Just under 700 feet long, she had a beam, not counting the flight deck, of 80 feet, 18,000 tonnes, 40,000 horsepower, and nominally 25 knots. She was not finished before the war ended, and so she just sat there. Now, I happen to have a machinery handbook here that has a stamp in it that says, in the front cover, Engineer Officer HMS Majestic. Of course, she was never commissioned as Majestic. Anyway, I guess through the years she just sat there, and during the Korean War, I'll take a guess, a punt, the Australian government decided it needed another aircraft carrier, having seen what Sydney was doing, providing air support for land operations in Korea during that war. And so they decided to acquire this ship, originally Majestic, renamed Melbourne, and she was ultimately commissioned in 1955 into the RAN. We'll have the next picture, thanks. This was part of her during that period, and I know that shipyard is not an Australian shipyard, so, and by the look of the antenna on the ship, it's during that interim period before 1955, undergoing an inclining experiment, which all ships do periodically through their life. We'll have the next one, please. And this is basically how she looked when she was commissioned. At commissioning, we didn't yet have the aircraft, but later that year we acquired Sea Venom jet fighters and those great hulking anti-submarine ferry gannets. And at the time she was commissioned, she was, although not the biggest, she was probably the most modern and advanced aircraft carrier in the world. And she had, for the first time in one ship, three elements necessary for effective modern naval aviation. And these were an angled flight deck, a steam catapult, and gyro-stabilised landing mirrors. And we, in our ship, were the first Navy to put all that together. Okay, we'll just go. That's a photo I took a bit later in 1963, two Sea Venoms. Next one, please. And that's quite a nice photo. I'm not sure of the origin of that one. Working on the flight deck. Next, please. Gannet, as you can see, a big aircraft with contra-rotating propellers. And let's see what how the next one comes up. And that's being shot off. I'm glad I was never in one of those. But anyway, my first contact, and yes, the SAR Hilo was a little old Sycamore. And I took that one and I put it in because I like the photo as much as anything else. 1963 up in the Far East somewhere, and that in the background is HMS Lion or Tiger, one of those big grit cruisers. My first contact with Melbourne was in 1963 as a direct entry engineer officer when I was posted there for 6 months to get my engineering watchkeeping certificates, you know, a boiler room ticket, engine room ticket and so on. Although she was relatively newly commissioned, all the machinery was World War II or pre-World War design and construction. It was all manually operated and there was an enormous amount of wild heat around the ship. And I guess if you were going up to the Arctic convoys, you didn't really mind that. She had two shafts. The starboard shaft or the starboard propeller had four blades. The port propeller had three blades. She was a direct current ship. She had five generators. And unlike most warships, which have a boiler room and an engine room for each shaft, she just had one big machinery compartment for each shaft, a forward machinery space, aft machinery space, each of which contained two boilers, a generator, a set of turbines, distilling plant, and other miscellaneous equipment. It was all very noisy and hot. Air conditioning at that time was almost non-existent, and in the tropics, my cabin on foredeck was 93 degrees Fahrenheit at night and 96 during the day, and it didn't vary from that. Mess decks around the ship were equally stinking hot. So after I left after 6 months, went to Parramatta and came back a year later, and I joined again as a watchkeeping engineer, and in Melbourne at that time, from memory, there were about 12 lieutenants in the engineering department. A two and a half who was senior engineer, and Commander E, who was head of department. We all shared HQ2, which was the secondary damage control headquarters, as our working office space. It was a pretty small compartment, from memory, something like 16, 18 feet square. It had heaps of consoles with sound pad phones on the bulkheads for damage control, firefighting, fuel and liquid management, into the machinery spaces, to the bridge and so forth, and lots of state boards. But on the port bulkhead, there was a little alcove, and that was Commander E's desk. And even though we all worked and lived almost in this little confined compartment, you still almost needed an appointment to speak to the engineer officer. He was God, but little did I know that 16 years later I'd come back as God. Okay, let's see. That previous photo was we used to at times put fire hoses onto the flight deck just to cool down. The tall gentleman in whites is Digby Johns, who was Commander Air at the time. And the other gentleman in white shorts was Ken Shands, who was the XO. He went on to become Commodore, or maybe two-star, I can't remember now. So we, or the engineering department, and that's a mess deck. I think it's one of the air group mess decks, but I'm not sure. It's on the ship side as opposed to one of the midships mess decks. What's the next picture though? There's a story behind that one, and if we have time at the end, I'll tell it. But the engineering department not only looked after all the normal equipment, but they also look after the catapult, the arresting gear, and the aviation fuel systems. You will have seen in movies and even news reports around during the Gulf Wars and so on, kids in bright coloured vests scuttling under aircraft, hooking them up and so on. Well, they're all my kids. And the catapult and the resting gear engineer used to report directly to myself when I was there anyhow. At flying stations, as someone mentioned it earlier, that used to get sometimes get quite tense, but in the forward machinery space, the boiler pressure would be raised from the normal 400 pounds per square inch to 430, which was only 15 pounds per square inch below the set point for the safety valves. And that used to test the metal of the steaming chief at the time, because there'd be all sorts of uneven steam drawdowns as they charged the catapult and so on, because the catapult had two big accumulators that were charged with steam to provide a steady steam pressure behind the pistons. And there was nothing more attention-grabbing than, say, during the middle watch when you're trying to keep awake and you get a full stern as the gannet loses power on the catapult, which did happen to me on one occasion. And during this period in 1965 in the Far East, and that's just a picture of supply, I think that's a British CA class destroyer or something like that up there, and that's Melbourne on the left in 65. We embarked a squadron of RN Wessex helos, and they were the helicopters, the first helicopters with the dunking sonar set. And I think that was a trial to check that we were able to operate them satisfactorily from Melbourne. I managed to hitch a ride on one of them, but it wasn't really successful, because every time they the pilot engaged the auto hover, it would dive downwards, which at 60 feet wasn't a very comfortable feeling. Anyway, I still have it in the back of my memory, and I'm not sure about this, that we might have had a touch and go from a Skyhawk while up in the Far East that year. And it was all exciting for a young lad like me. My next contact, well, there are the Wessex helos in the Far East. My next contact with the ship was in 1968. Excuse me. I was posted to Garden Island, and I was immediately told to take charge of a set-to-work team to get Melbourne going again after the modernisation that year, where she was refurbished, refitted, and converted to enable her to fly Skyhawk aircraft, Grumman Tracker, anti-submarine, as well as Seeking Helos. And it was a bit of a disappointment, because I was hoping to get away from steam for a while. But anyway, the catapult and arresting gear were upgraded. There was storage for 70,000 gallons of avgas, not avcat, avgas, gasoline. 133,000 gallons of avcat. There were new avionics. There were two new alternators put in, a turbo-driven alternator and a diesel-driven alternator. There were TVs throughout the mess decks, improved air conditioning, a liquid oxygen plant, electric engine telegraphs. Some of these things you think are pretty trivial, but you'll see why I mention them later on. These are the main changes, and the ship's displacement was now 20,000 tonnes. Unfortunately, the poor old ship seemed to never be far away from trouble. While I was still at Garden Island in 1969, there was a collision that Melbourne had with the USS Evans off the Philippines, and I saw her coming back up the harbour towards Cockatoo for a new bow. And I also saw, when she was alongside the fitting out wharf in Garden Island, a freighter coming out of Woolloomooloo managed to collide with her port after Swanson. She didn't have much saying that. And on another occasion, the Sydney Harbour ferry ran right up the stern, right up the backside, so to speak. None of those were her fault, but anyway. But the press always got hold of them. And in the mid-70s, when I think David Martin was commanding officer, the big new LWO2 antenna fell off over the side into the Tasman Sea somewhere. Now, I don't know what was behind that. But she did give sterling service through until the 80s. Now, there's a Skyhawk getting ready to go up to be launched. And the little bit sticking up out of the flight deck in the foreground, we call the howdah, and that used to lift up so that the petty officer operating the catapult could see what was happening around in addition to receiving verbal instructions. And that would be sitting alongside in the white overalls the catapult engineer. Is there another one? That, I'm not sure where that photo came from, but it looks pretty good, I think. And of course, that big heap of webbing is the emergency barrier if and when needed. I never saw it actually deployed in anger. Let's see what... that's a picture I scanned off a publication I saw, which is pretty good, I think. And I think there's a... And there's a good picture of flight deck operations. I don't know what the event is, but it must have been something, because look at all the goofers around on the island there. So I don't know what it was, but it's a pretty good set of activities. You can see my kids there under the Skyhawk getting it ready. What else is it? And there we go, that's in Pearl Harbor. There's none of the American carriers to compare it with, so it looks pretty good. In the South China Sea, I took that one in, I think that was probably about 1971. Fleet entry sometime in the 70s, she's leading, she's got the Skyhawks and Trackers there with a Type 12 of some kind, I think a Daring and another Type 12 following her. And there's a picture inside the hangar deck. You can see how tight it is. There's Skyhawks at this end, and at the forward end, you can just see the folded wings of the Trackers, if you look carefully. Not much room for error. And, of course, she did lots of other things, like fuel ships at sea and so forth. I think that's Hobart, by the way. We'll wait till we get to that one. I was appointed MEO in 1981, and that's when I renewed my acquaintance with her, although I had dealings on paper when I was in Navy office. And really, time hadn't mellowed her, but, as I said, now I was God. One thing I learnt as MEO, there were 103 vertical steps from the forward machinery space up to the bridge. And many's the time I counted them as I had to report main engines to the commanding officer, and I always hoped that the machinery state was still the same when I got there as when I left. One never was quite sure. But 81 was quite a busy year. We just deployed to the Far East again. We worked around the East Australian Exercise Area, and we participated in Kangaroo 81 off Shoalwater Bay in Queensland. As we left Manila, bound for the Far East in company with USS Coral Sea, which is a while and old but still a pretty big US carrier and its task force, my catapult engineer had a medical problem and we had to cease flying. Why else does an aircraft carrier go to sea? I didn't get many brownie points out of that one. Did you know that the catapult, which is a very complex technical system, never had a handbook? All we had was notes written into a handbook by hand by a previous engineer officer, whom I think was Mark Russell. Let's just see what else we've got. Oh, that's taken during the trip to the Far East, and there are some of my engineering watchkeeping lieutenants just having a bit of time in the sun. They all look pretty fit and healthy, don't they? What's next? Okay, we'll come to that one. in due course. One of my favourite times was to at sea was to, if we're flying at night, was to go up on the flight deck and sit with my catapult engineer by the Hadar, which was that bit that comes up out of the flight deck, when the trackers were flying. Because the tracker would come up and get ready for launch, and the flight deck officer would wave his flag for him to put the power on. And these had big radial engines, gasoline-driven engines, and you'd get sheets of orange and blue and red flame and red-hot carbon flying out into the atmosphere. And, of course, you could only see it at night. At daytime, there was nothing there. But it was a magnificent sight. You were squatting under the wing of this aircraft, which was shaking, and eventually your flag would go down. 2 seconds later, the catapult would fire, and away it would go. Now, just out of interest, I have here part of the holdback system of the catapult. In addition to the sling that pulls it off, it's held back, fastened to the structure of the ship, and this is designed to break at a fixed point. And if I can, yes, here we go. It's designed to break at a force of 28,500 pounds. It doesn't look much, but it's very precisely machined so that the aircraft can always start with the same thrust on the pistons that are going to accelerate it. Of course, this was pretty important with Melbourne because the stroke of the catapult was only something like 96, 97 feet long, and it had to get to 100 odd knots by the time it had got there. One of the other things that had happened in my absence, and I mentioned we had internal TV in the ship, was we really only generated enough fresh water for 90-second showers. And to tell someone that they only had 90 seconds of water for showers would have been a bit harsh. So at some stage, the Habitability Committee had encouraged a lady from King's Cross to give a genuine full frontal demonstration of how to have a 90-second shower. And every few nights, we would put this over the internal TV system, and it certainly got people's attention. And they used to like the lathering up bit, I think. Okay. We survived that deployment. Excuse me. And we did other sea time. But there is one incident that really comes to my mind, I still get the cold shivers over it at times. As I said earlier, two AC alternators were built into the ship, and these were needed basically for the new electronics, avionics, and all the communication systems. But you can't make a soup purse out of a sow's ear. Normally we steamed with just a turbo alternator running and no backup. The diesel alternator was there in case. Well, I was on the bridge this particular afternoon. We were heading at about 12 knots from memory towards a nice sandy shelving beach, and we were going to do an anchorage. And just as we were about to pipe specialty dutymen, the turbo alternator tripped and all communications failed. External, internal, and the ship was totally out of control. The voice pipe to the wheelhouse was pretty useless. It was something like a 60 or 90 foot run. No one could understand it. It had never been used. The sand-powered telephone down to the machinery space, all you could hear was, "What's that? What's that? Say again." Too much noise on the receiving end. And we were just sailing to the beach. And I literally raised a cold sweat at that stage. But eventually the diesel alternator got underway, things came back to normal, and we managed to and we gained control. But it was not a nice feeling at the time. Okay, this picture I took myself, and the next one, and we've gone one too far. That one and were taken in November 1981, and that was the very last fixing operations when we flew off the squadron back to Nowra for the very last time before the ship decommissioned. And there the track is all lining up, and the next one, the wings are spread, the engines are going, and after that there was no more fixing flying. The Sar Hilo in the background there. So we arrived back in Sydney in November 81, and we sat alongside for 3 months, nominally preparing for an extension of life refit. I say nominally, no one had any heart in it, but that's what on paper we were supposed to be doing. But even then, the ship still had little dramas to keep us on our toes. We'd have floods. One of the distilling plant managed to literally split open like a sardine can. Anyway, she just decommissioned. The decision was made to decommission her, and all these problems evaporated away. And she decommissioned at the end of June 1982. Let me give you a few quotes from the engineering master record. You don't need to be an engineer to appreciate them. This is from Fleet Maintenance Bulletin that was published by the Fleet Maintenance Department in Navy Office. Telegraphs. Ancient lengths of rod gearing cause many inaccurate indications. Halfway between stop and slow creates confusion amongst the throttle platform watchkeepers. Sirens. To my memory, the sirens in Melbourne have been a cause for mirth since 1959, when the ship steamed with a bucket hanging from each. There were steam sirens, and obviously there were leaks in the system and allowing steam up. It was condensing and dripping on people underneath, which of course didn't look very nice. And I remember this personally, because I overheard it, from the NBCD officer to the double bottoms engineer officer. While the ship was in dry dock, they're at a fifth of the degree list. Do something about it. So, anyway, there's more there. Where are we at?
Enough light.
Yes. And so finally, I read an article, and I finished that article off with these words, which I think are still appropriate. Designed for use in the Arctic convoys of World War II, launched in 1944, left unloved until acquired by Australia, finally commissioned into the RAN in 1955, a leader in naval aviation at this time, a turbulent life with fixed wing, with final fixed wing operations in November 1981, decommissioned in 1982. She was a great leveller, providing stability to the RAN, and for generations of officers and sailors, she was a measured, standardised yardstick for training, leadership, tradition, and life at sea in our service. There is one thing I think that I miss, and I'm sure a lot of people, other people would miss, and that is the performance of ceremonial sunset by the fleet band in some foreign port. Many of the times that I've watched foreign dignitaries, senior military officers, moved by the haunting music as the ensign was lowered. The day they give us Lord Nowra is ended with the words of the hymn. I think that was pretty inexpensive diplomacy. Anyway, that was basically a thumbnail of Melbourne. A few months after I left Melbourne, I was posted to the UK to take an exchange posting with the Royal Navy. I was sent up to Newcastle on Tyne, where I was on the staff of an organisation called the Principal Naval Overseer Brackets Tyne, overseeing the construction of Ark Royal, a Type 42 destroyer and a couple of Type 22 frigates at Swan Hunter Shipbuilders. And there was other interesting work going on. With the arrival of an Australian brass hat, the rumour immediately went around the yard that there was going to be an order for a fourth aircraft carrier, but regrettably no. The overseeing organisation of which I was part was very interesting, and it was run by a member of the Royal Corps of Naval Constructors. Now, that's an interesting organisation, peculiar to the Royal Navy. The Royal Corps of Naval Constructors was, I guess, a professional home of naval architects employed by the Ministry of Defence. It was established by Royal Decree in 1883, and I was lucky enough to go to their centenary dinner in 1983. Interestingly, all constructors went to sea for 2 years early on in their career, and they wore uniform. They wore a lieutenant's uniform with grey distinguishing lace. I found them to be very professional and competent, and the organisations they ran were very effective. We were largely left alone by head office in Bath in the south of England, provided that the contractor's costs and schedule were being maintained. And as an aside, in Australia, I went to work for Tenix in Williamstown when it was privatised, and we were building two FFGs and 10 Anzac-class frigates. And really, the Department of Defence team on site, in my eyes, in comparison with what I was experienced, they were immature, they were inexperienced, and at times incompetent, and Canberra just couldn't keep its fingers out of the pie. Anyway, that's my view. I could spend another half hour talking about interesting jobs that I did up on the Tyne, but I've been asked to say a few words about Ark Royal. There will be a few, but she was designed to operate short takeoff and vertical landing aircraft, such as a Harrier. And one of her sister ships, Invincible, I think, did sterling work during the Falklands War. She had the classic ski jump flight deck. At 22,000 tonnes, she was slightly heavier than the Melbourne, but she was also physically larger and higher because of a lighter construction and more modern construction techniques. She was about the same length, 698 feet long, 120-foot beam and 24-foot draft. I think Melbourne's was about 23-foot draft. She was propelled by four Olympus gas turbine, getting 120,000 horsepower on two shafts, and she could give 30 knots or thereabouts. Quite an impressive ship. And she had some degree of armament. She had sea dart, she had phalanx, and she had 20mm mountings. She could take up to 18 Harriers and 4 Sea Kings, or some variations thereof. About 1,000 crew, and they were marvellous ships. It was a pity we didn't take one when Margaret Thatcher offered the Ark Royal to us. And that, in the constraints of time, is really all I've put together. The article I referred to at the very beginning of this talk was my proposition that Melbourne, by the time she reached the end of her life, was actually unseaworthy. And I expected to have Asy or someone at the door, and most of the admirals at the time are now no longer with us, so no one's actually worried me about it. So I have, as I said, two or three books here. Machinery Handbook. This was written by Garden Island, based on the original one here, produced by Vickers Armstrong, Barrow and Furness. By today's standards of documentation, pretty scant. Specifications for all the major equipment in it. This is a damage control handbook. So we basically made it up as we went along, I think, a lot of the time.
I've got a couple of questions.
Yes.
You start at the very beginning, you mentioned that the port screw had three blades, the starboard screw had four. I can only imagine that that was to compensate for the drag caused by the island superstructure on the starboard side. Would that be right?
I don't think so, but I haven't heard that one. I would say it was to do with axial vibrations in the shafting. Have you got anything, Tom?
Yes. The original 10 Colossus class suffered very much from vibrations, and this was because this was the Majestic class, which was the last six of the 16 ordered. They solved the problem of shaft vibration by having, what you just said, four blades and three blades. That's the reason.
Okay. And the other question was that in Sydney 3,
yes,
with Hawker Sea Furies and Ferry Fireflies, every single time an aircraft was catapulted off, the strop went into the drink. And they said, now any sailor can come up with an idea of retaining the strop will be a rich man, because, you know, you've got, and they insisted on hand eye splices and a hand cut splice. No swages allowed in those days. And I think the steel wire rope alone was worth £15, but the labour in doing the splicing would be considerably more. Now, I know they've got a different system now, but you still see that splash in the drink. So do they still lose a strop every time?
Let me think. Certainly with Sea Venoms and Gannets, yes, the strop went straight into the ocean. I think there was a catching device installed in 1968 for the strops for the Venoms, and not the Venoms, the Skyhawks and the Trackers. Now, whether it was effective, I don't know. That was usually the least of my worries. The fact that they got off safely, I was more interested in.
It's also with American carriers too.
Yeah. The American carriers, we obviously copied what the Americans were doing.
Yeah,
that's correct. 1969 bridal arrested here was called and installed.
What was it called?
Bridal arrested here.
Right, thanks.
But yes, in those early days, prior to the modernisation, there was a lot of manual work done. The arresting gear centre sections all had hand poured thimbles and whatever with white metal. We actually carried coppersmiths to do that sort of work. Any more questions? I'm happy to take, or we can go on to other subjects if there's more time. I'll tell you, you will recall I showed you a picture of a whaler hanging under the port quarter of the flight deck at the stern. Well, that was in 1964-65, when I was a watchkeeper there. That's a standard Puss's whaler, Montague rig, I think, with five oars. Some of you will recall the sort of annual ritual of Admiral's inspection. And it was strong and active in the 60s, and the fleet, or Melbourne and other units, quite often used to go up to Hervey Bay. Out of the way, peaceful, waste lots of paint, throw the tins overboard, and spend a week or so up there doing their annual Admiral's inspection. Well, while we're at anchor, with not a lot happening, six or eight of us engineer officers said, we'll go ashore and we'll have a banyan and we'll take the whaler and we'll sail. So We sailed the whaler to some deserted little beach, had our banyan, and when we went to put stuff back, guess where the tide was? We're in no state to try to drag the vessel. So we had sail there, and eventually we just had to wait there for the tide to come in and start rowing, because there wasn't a breath of wind. And there was someone even standing in the bow with a cigarette lighter, and it wasn't blowing out. So eventually one of the ship's boats found us and towed us back. But these things happen.
That's like fun, don't it?
Yes, any other?
Okay, thank you. Any more questions, please?
When you lost communication and you talked about the diesel alternator,
yes,
did that cut in automatically?
No, no, we had to... Well, obviously the team was organised if things went black. They rushed down and started up, but it was a manual exercise. Definitely, we weren't that smart in those days. I mean, it was feasible, but it certainly wasn't built into the ship. Yes.
Were our main engines reliable, but would they be turbines?
Or yes, they were steam turbines, and they were, I think, very reliable, maybe not over-efficient, but very reliable. I only ever really had one problem with them, and that was when I think we actually rubbed a turbine, but we figured out how to fix it, and we didn't tell anyone, and we carried on, and the ship was about to pay off anyhow. So why steal a hornet's nest? But no, they were very, very basic, and they did the job.
And what sort of speed would you often cruise at when you have a particular speed?
Maximum speed I think we could ever get out of Melbourne would probably 22, 23 knots.
Mm-hmm.
But during exercises and so on, anywhere from 10 to 15 knots was a fairly regular sort of speed. Mm-hmm. But we always had all four boilers working all the time, unlike, say, the FFGs, which had... not the FFGs, the DDGs, which had four boilers. You could get 28 knots out of two boilers, and you only ever had two boilers running at any one time, normally.
So you ran four all the time?
All the time, yes. There just wasn't enough power to do anything else.
You needed all that speed?
We need them all, yes, yes.
So when you had flying happening as well?
Yes.
You didn't have extra steam capacity to draw on, or you?
Well, as I said, we used
crank up the pressure.
Mm. And basically, as you pulled off more steam, you obviously burn more fuel and so on. Mm-hmm. And every time you fired the catapult, I think it was about half a ton of seawater from memory, something of that order.
Mm-hmm. Were the boilers completely manually operated, or were there any forms of automatic or semi-automatic control?
No, everything was manual, but the only thing that was vaguely non-manual was the float-operated water level control, which is an elementary, they call it a robo-controller, which is just a simple float-operated device. But you had a steaming PO or chief, you had a sprayer puncher on each boiler, you had a water tender, and I think from memory there were one or two other guys hanging around somewhere. Mm-hmm. And the boiler PO had controls, and he could control the amount of oil being burnt in the sprayers, but he had to tell his sprayer punchers to add new sprayers on, take them off, and so forth.
Mm-hmm. Was she more sophisticated than a sister? Like, I think was Bonaventure a sister from Canada?
I think so.
The Argentinians.
And the Argentinians had one, the Indians had called their Vikram. And I think they were all pretty well much the same.
The Dutch had one as well.
And the Dutch had one. Mm-hmm. And I think the only significant difference that I know about between, say, those ships and Sydney and her class of ships was that the boilers were enclosed in Melbourne, whereas the whole machine space was pressurised in Sydney, which is what the bearings had.
What responsibilities did you have with the electrics in the ship?
We were going through the stage of handing over power electrics to the Marine Engineering Department at that time, and so it was a bit messy. But the Navy as a whole transferred power electrics to the MS side, and I think that's where it now resides. But basically, we didn't have control over the electrical sailors, therefore we didn't have control over the electrics. And we didn't operate, or my kids didn't operate the switchboards, although I reckon some of them probably could have.
Well, the main switchboard area or room in the ship, yes, a magnificent area. I had a look at it yes, when she was laid up. They had the big chromium signs of British Electric Company, and all the black material was there. What a pity. That whole area should have been taken out. It would have made a fabulous display, or even a set of a Hollywood or something.
It certainly would. It certainly would.
It was very, very impressive.
And it was right adjacent to HQ1.
Mm.
They were all... you just had an open door between the main switchboard and HQ1 from memory. Yes, it was a nice, smart, clean area. Yeah. Whereas, for example, in the DDGs, the switchboards were in the engine room, and they weren't smart, shiny places.
And you carried Wessex and Sea Kings, didn't you?
Not at the same time.
Not at the same time.
No. No. I think the Sea Kings superseded the Wessex, basically. And the Sea Kings have only just recently been taken out of service. But the Wessex were the first sort of sonar dunking type anti-submarine helos that we had, and the Sea Kings were developments on that. But don't get me too much into aviation. I'm not that strong on it. Yeah.
So after her last brief, you mentioned she was a little heavier than she'd been.
Whether that was totally because of it, but it, certainly the conversion in 1968 did add weight to the ship. How much I, off the top of my head, I couldn't say, but all ships, you allow a growth factor and things just get added on. And through the 70s, for example, habitability was always a problem. So I'm not sure how it happened, but eventually there was a habitability fund set up which the ship and the fleet could manage outside of Navy office alterations and additions, cumbersome processes. And so I have no doubt that added weight as people added stuff on.
So would she have ended up a little heavier than her sister ship, the Sydney?
I think so, yes. Yes, I think considerably heavier, because the angle flight deck itself would have added weight over and above the original 18,000-tonne displacement design.
Melbourne had air conditioning, didn't it, whereas Sydney only had forced ventilation.
Melbourne had some vague sort of air conditioning prior to 68. It had improved air conditioning after 68, but some of it was still sort of basically wartime design, and you can imagine it wasn't too effective. So the mess decks were pretty horrible places to be.
You said she was really seaworthy at the end. Was yes, that just plating was worn, or what?
I believe, and this is my belief, but there's no one to contradict me, and the ship's not here, that the structure of the hull itself had deteriorated. The flight, if you look, think of the hull as an I-beam, flanges top and bottom that give it rigidity. The top flange was the flight deck, and there were numerous fractures between the flight deck and the beams and the columns supporting it. So it wasn't well fastened, and the double bottom areas certainly around the middle of the ship, which were fuel tanks, had deteriorated so badly that we didn't use them, and the structure was rotten basically. So it wasn't really the plating, in fact probably the plating was holding it together, but I think the whole hull structure had lost its integrity. That was my opinion anyhow.
In the end we were going to get invincible, weren't we, and then it was a turnaround after the 4.0.
It was. I think the two Prime Ministers played a little bit of politics, and I know one or two of the people involved there, or I've heard stories, and as I said, when I arrived on the scene, when they were building Ark Royal, they said, aha, Australia's going to build one now. But not to be.
Tom?
Yes?
People might be interested to know that AC generator that you had to get up and running.
Yes.
Was a Paxman V16. And it is now the emergency generator for Falls Creek Snow Resort.
Good. Would they be the same as Tac Pass Patrol Boat main engines? They had Paxman 16, but I don't know if they'd be.
I don't know. But
I think this is about a 1 megawatt, or, no, 750 megawatt, 750 kilowatt machine.
Still running, eh?
Yeah, well, it's the emergency generator.
Oh, right.
I know Paxman did have problems at one stage. I don't even know if they're still in business now. Probably.
Well, the reason they had trouble in patrol boats was because they were designed for a T-class railway locomotive. The diesel railway locomotive, and they didn't like running at varying speeds, and when you put them into ships, you know, and you wanted them to go slow for a long, long time and then speed up and all that sort of thing, it wasn't quite what they were designed for, really.
Yeah, I think one of the problems with a lot of diesel engines, you use them for applications they're not designed for, and they give you problems. And diesel engines do not like low power.
Well, that clogs up all the injectors.
Well, yeah, you get a lot of carbon build up in cylinders and so on, and the exhaust ports and so forth. I'm not a real expert in diesel engines, but I think a modicum of knowledge. Yes?
Was then the Melbourne the largest steam power vessel in the REM?
It was the largest. It was the largest vessel, it wasn't the most powerful one.
No, but the largest steam-powered
vessel
in REM.
It was the largest steam-powered vessel that we've had.
Right.
But as I said, it wasn't the most powerful steam-powered.
Would they have been the destroyers?
The DDGs had 70,000 horsepower. Melbourne had 40,000 horsepower.
Right. Thank you.
Now, when we got rid of Melbourne, we thought we'd got rid of, oh, and of course the DDG, we thought we'd got rid of, Melbourne was the last ship to burn FFA, wasn't it?
Yes. Then, it was never converted to diesel.
No. Now, with the DDGs, we got rid of steam, but now Sirius, which is the biggest displacement, I think, in the RAN still, and I've got an idea, does that run on steam, or does it, what does it run on?
I would take a guess and say it's a diesel driven ship. They might have steam auxiliary steam systems.
Oh, okay.
But I don't know. I'm only guessing there because I've had nothing to do with the ship.
Someone told me it burned FFO again.
Well, some of those
some of the diesel ships do. You have to eat it before you put it through the engine.
Yeah, some diesel ships can burn quite rubbishy stuff.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Well, they do. Most of the merchant ships burn FFO with diesels.
Was your last steam-powered ship the Kimmler, the boom defence, originally boom defence vessel?
I'm not sure when Kimmler paid off, but she was certainly steam. But she had old Scots boilers rather than
three drums,
rather than water tube boilers.
Thank you.
But now I think the last steamships we had were the DDGs, and Brisbane was disposed of back 2000, 2001, something like that. But as I said, you could, on two boilers, you could do, after the diesel conversion, you could do 28 knots on two boilers, and I got in excess of 36 on four.
Wow.
If you knew how to do it. The tricks that young players don't do, isn't it? Yes.
One, with the, in the galley, did the cook, was the cooking using superheated steam that you generate?
I think, and respecting my memory a bit, it would use exhaust range steam, which was about 40 psi, but it was pretty superheated because it had been expanded through turbines and so on. And, although whether it had been de-superheated or not, I can't remember. But,
it was exhaust steam, wasn't it?
I think it was exhaust steam, so it would have been fairly superheated at about 40 psi, so it was pretty hot. But mind you, there were some pretty long pipe runs in Melbourne, so it might have sort of cooled a bit by the time it got there. Yes. But,
so we got any more questions for you? I think by the quality of the questions, everyone's found it extremely interesting. I certainly have. And I'd like to say thank you very much.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
Thank you.